Your silence is commanded.
Please be seated. Afternoon. Before, I'll call the first case and only case for this afternoon, 01-2139, Eric M. Schmitz versus First Star Bank, Milwaukee. Before you begin your argument, I would like to explain the two empty chairs on either side of me. I am not contagious or infectious, and no one's angry at the moment, Justice Babbage, who sits to my right, is not well, but he is not participating in this case. And Justice Wilcox, who is also not well, is not participating in this case. So we are down to five. We need a quorum of four. So I think we're going to make it. Okay, how do you all feel? Good.
Hopefully well.
Hopefully well. Got to make it for an hour. Arguing from Eric M. Schmitz is Joseph G. Doherty of Bunk, Doherty & Griffin of West Bend. Counsel?
Good afternoon, Justices. I do want to correct. My office is now called the Doherty Law Office, not Bunk, Doherty & Griffin.
Hey.
Good afternoon, Justices.
If you have a change of address or something,
no.
You should notify the clerk's office.
The address, everything is the same, other than just a name change. My name is Joe Doherty. I do represent the plaintiff appellant in this case. Before I begin my argument, I do want to apologize to the court for two errors that appear in my principal brief. On page number 5, in the middle of the page, there is a reference to the record 67, appellant's appendix 67. It should be appellant's appendix 2829. On page 14, the last sentence, it says, actual authority is the first word in the last sentence. That should be apparent authority. And I apologize to the court for those errors. I believe this case is before the Supreme Court because of the failure of the lower courts to recognize and fully appreciate the difference between actual authority and apparent authority. The trial court and the affirming court of appeals denied summary judgment to the plaintiff and granted summary judgment to the defendant First Star, dismissing all of the claims of Mr. Schmitz as against First Star. There are other parties not party to this appeal, just the First Star is all we're addressing. At the heart of this case are two limited powers of attorney that were executed by Mr. Schmitz in 1992 when he was in the process of transferring life insurance and other investments from his prior broker to Georgetown Financial Corporation. Georgetown was a ma-and-pop operation in Mequon, Wisconsin. Its principal owner and only owner and principal executive was James O'Hearn. James O'Hearn was the only contact my client had at Georgetown Financial. It is our position that the granting of the summary judgment should have been defeated for three basic reasons. The first reason is that the actual limited powers of attorney, the two powers of attorney, our position is they do not grant the authority for James O'Hearn and his corporation, Georgetown, to self-deal and steal the funds of their client, Eric Schmitz. In a corollary to that argument is that even if the court would decide that those limited powers of attorney, those two documents executed in 1992, did grant the authority to steal these funds, the limited powers of attorney, as a matter of law, were terminated by conduct of O'Hearn and Georgetown subsequent to the execution of those documents, and I'm going to develop that argument in a few minutes. The third reason I do not believe that summary judgment should have been granted is that as to the check for the $58,599 and change, is that that check was never properly negotiated. The check was stamped by Mr. O'Hearn with his corporate stamp for deposit only to Georgetown account, and First Star then negotiated that check and deposited those funds to the Georgetown account. That is not a proper endorsement under the statutes that were in existence at the time. The other thing I want to talk about is the latest development in this case. For the first time in this appeal, the defendant, First Star, has raised the position that the limited powers of attorney were given to Georgetown, not to O'Hearn. And I want to address that. It's a distinction without a difference. Mr. O'Hearn was the only representative Mr. Schmitz had any contact with, and the conduct of O'Hearn was the conduct of Georgetown. That argument has no weight. It just doesn't hold any water. And I'll try to develop that as I go on a little further.
Mr. Doherty, if I could interrupt for a minute. I want to ask you about that $58,000 check. When was that deposited in the account at First Star?
In July of 1996.
Were talking about the law in existence at that time. What change occurred in the law that you think is important?
I don't think there was any change in the law. I'm just saying I didn't cite the statutes from the current statutes. What's cited in the brief are the statutes from 1993-94, which was the law in force at the time. There were some misprints in the statutes. I don't think there's any significant difference other than those statutes were repealed and recreated by different statutes. Essentially, the law is the same, but that is the law that was written at the time, the statutory law.
All right, because there were some changes in 1996, but you think that was basically just repealed and recreating the same basic law?
I don't think they were substantive changes, Your Honor. But I don't think we get at the endorsement issue if we look at the limited powers of attorney. There were two limited powers of attorney, and they are part of the appendix on pages 6 and 7. And the limited powers of attorney, these are copies. The originals were never located. It should be known that these limited powers of attorney were first discovered after this lawsuit was commenced, I believe in the year 2000. Going through some of the archives of the Georgetown files or Mr. Schmitz files were photocopies, and that's what is produced. The originals, I can only presume, were provided to these other brokerage houses that transferred those assets from those existing accounts to Georgetown. But what's important, what I see what's important in these limited powers of attorney, specifically in handwriting on those powers of attorney, are the investments that are being liquidated and transferred to Georgetown. There is American Funds, a mutual fund. There is AMCAP, another mutual fund. Washington Mutual is an insurance policy. On the second one, the American Funds was, and the policy number is given for that particular mutual fund. The intent of these limited powers of attorney were to transfer assets. They were not intended by Mr. Schmitz or Georgetown or Mr. O'Hearn to give them the authority to steal his money.
Counsel, the argument that it doesn't give someone the authority to steal, I mean, I'd say absolutely, you know. Who's arguing that they have the authority to steal? What does, in my mind anyway, what does Appendix 7, the latter of the two power of attorneys, assuming that it doesn't give authority to steal, what does it give authority to do? How do you interpret that?
What I believe it does is it gives that particular document specific authority for Georgetown to transfer the American Funds mutual fund policy number 572, et cetera, from the American Fund portfolio to Georgetown. That's all that it is doing to do.
Is it required that the subject of the limited power of attorney be listed below? Do the words of this power of attorney require that?
Well, it says as the owner of the insurance policies identified below, the very first sentence of the limited power of attorney. I, Eric M. Schmitz, as owner of the life insurance policies identified below, do hereby designate Georgetown, etc. So it does by reference talk about the listed life insurance policies below. Later on, in general language, it says it applies to stocks, bonds, other types of investments. My argument is that also has to be a listed document or a listed fund or a listed investment down below to give the authority.
And tell me why that is your argument. What are you basing it on?
I'm basing it on that powers of attorney have to be strictly construed. These citations in my brief.
Yes. Mm-hmm. What are you basing it on in terms of the words of this power of attorney? That any asset that is the subject of the power of attorney has to be listed below. That's your argument. What words in this limited power of attorney require that?
Just the first sentence, and that's a specific language that says the insurance policies have to be listed below. The general language that then follows from that has to comply with the specific language as to the authority cited in my brief. I don't want to get lost on this. I mean, the Prafke decision that was decided by the Court of Appeals after this case was brought up to the Court of Appeals talks in terms of where you have general language giving broad authority to an agent, there has to be specific exact language if the agent is going to be allowed to gift for themselves. Any kind of self-dealing is my extension of the Prafke decision or of the Alexopoulos decision, where, again, self-dealing type of things, the general broad language doesn't cover that type of self-dealing by the agent. And what better type of self-dealing is there than theft? My argument is it's first star is saying they had the authority to steal this man's money because that's the end result of what happened. The bottom line here is first star did not know of the existence of these limited powers of attorney until this lawsuit was started. Their only way they could win this case, in my opinion, is if they relied on the doctrine of apparent authority. Apparent authority is created when the principal communicates or manifests to a third party that an agent can act for them. And in our discovery, we had first our concede that they did not know of the existence of the limited powers of attorney at any time relevant. They did not rely on them, and that they only discovered them after the commencement of this lawsuit. Apparent authority drops by the side. There is, and they have now conceded in their reply brief they have now conceded that they cannot rely on apparent authority. That's not the case.
Gardy, didn't the Court of Appeals basically come to the conclusion that there was actual authority?
They did, but they were confused by misinterpreting. The reason I say is there was a lack of complete understanding of actual authority. They took and misconstrued section 112 of the Restatement of Agency Second, and they used a comment C to that document, or to Restatement 112, that talked in terms of, I'll quote from it, and that's where I get to page. Section 112 of the restatement reads, unless otherwise agreed, the authority of an agent terminates if without knowledge of the principal he acquires adverse interests or if he is otherwise guilty of a serious breach of loyalty to the principal. Comment C says, liability to third persons. Quote, if after being so disloyal that his authority to act is terminated, the agent deals with a third person on account of the principal, the power of the agent to make the principal a party to the transaction is not affected unless the third person has notice of the facts. See section 165 and 171. And the mistake that the Court of Appeals made was they are taking that and treating that as actual authority, yet the reference to 165 and 171 of the restatement are for disclosed or partially disclosed agents, which is apparent authority. And so what they did is they misconstrued third-party liability of a principal in a actual authority case by relying on the law under apparent authority. And that's where I say that the lower court, including the Court of Appeals, doesn't understand the distinction between actual authority and apparent authority. Apparent authority is out of this case. It is conceded it's out of the case. Now,
could I ask you, is reference to the American funds, is that an insurance policy?
No, that is a mutual fund. We, just as a side, we settled with American funds before the lawsuit was ever started.
Well, I understand.
That's another issue, but they are a mutual fund.
Reference on Appendix 7, you talk about the language at the beginning of the limited power of attorney. As owner of life insurance policies identified below, the American funds, that isn't an insurance policy, you just told me.
It is not. That is true. It is an investment that is a catch-all in the last sentence of that limited power of attorney. Power of attorney also applies to stocks, bonds, CDs, annuities, savings accounts, and other securities. It is a security. A mutual fund is a security under the SEC rules. And American funds is no different than the Putnam mutual funds.
Well, why isn't that last sentence a pretty broad grant of authority to deal with financial instruments?
And it is a broad granting of authority. However, it is contrary to the specific language above that. No different than in the Prefke decision or the Alexopoulos decision, where you had broad overall authority granted to the agent to do things on behalf and handle all financial affairs of the principal.
I understand what you're saying, but the language above doesn't even refer to an insurance, or it refers to an insurance policy, and yet there's no insurance policy listed.
Not on this particular power of attorney. On number 6, there are, on page, or appendix 6, the first power of attorney, there are listed life insurance policies.
Well, there's a mutual fund, and there's an insurance policy. But in this limited power of attorney on appendix 7, we've got CDs and bonds and annuities and savings accounts, which have nothing to do with either insurance policies or mutual funds. Isn't that right?
Arguably, that is true. And I believe that if they wanted to liquidate a CD, they would have had to list the CD on that document, just like they had to list the mutual funds, just like they listed the insurance policy. The agent and the principal, keep in mind, this actual authority is a manifestation from the principal to the agent. It has nothing to do with a third party. And between the principal and the agent, there was an understanding he had to list these on the power of attorney to get the authority to deal with those particular investments or life insurance policies or whatever was used there.
Can I ask you, what is the significance limited power of attorney? What is the difference between that and just power of attorney?
It's a word that Mr. O'Hearn on behalf of Georgetown added. It is not a general broad-based power of attorney. It is a limited power of attorney to deal only with the specific enumerated and listed investments or life insurance that's on the document. That's my contention.
Who drafted these limited power of attorney forms?
It's not in the record. It never became an issue. But the bottom line is these were Georgetown documents that my client signed. They were drafted by representatives of Georgetown. They were presented to him when he came to them, here, sign this so I can get your investments from these other investment places you have into here so we can do a better job in investing your monies. That was done in 1992. And I don't want to take too much time on this idea of was there actual authority, because even if this court construes that there's actual authority for O'Hearn and Georgetown to do this, these documents, these limited powers of attorney, terminated as a matter of law in 1994. In 1994, James O'Hearn, his securities license in the state of Wisconsin was terminated. He has never, ever had a license ever again in this state. But and those documents are part of the appendix.
But do you have to have the credentials that he was terminated from in order to have a limited power of attorney?
No. What you have to have is in order to legally sell the Putnam funds. The way he got the $58,000 is O'Hearn calls up Putnam as a licensed securities dealer and said, Putnam, liquidate this account and mail me the check for $58,000. That is an illegal act when Mr. O'Hearn did not possess the securities license. That's under Chapter 551.31 of the statutes. So the fact that he lost his securities license, he could no longer legally in this state act as an investment advisor. He could no longer buy and sell securities for his clients. He continued to do so from 1994 through 1998 when the federal government came in and prosecuted him and found him guilty of a number of charged him and ultimately found him guilty of fraud and sentenced him to prison.
Mr. Daugherty, isn't it significant that the power of attorney is not to O'Hearn but to Georgetown Financial?
It is
Georgetown
not.
Financial didn't lose their license in 1994.
All right. Georgetown Financial didn't have a license at any time. Georgetown Financial is the employer of James O'Hearn. Mm-hmm. And the problem I have is, and I don't want to belabor this point, that's the first time that was raised was in the brief filed at this level, is they're raising a distinction between O'Hearn and Georgetown. I contend there is no difference. And the reason there is no difference, O'Hearn is the chief operating officer and sole shareholder of Georgetown. They, Georgetown, were fully aware at all times of the conduct of O'Hearn. If O'Hearn loses his license and it becomes illegal for him to operate, Georgetown is surely aware of that. And when O'Hearn sells the Putnam Fund and generates this $58,000, Georgetown is certainly aware of it because there's a transaction and a confirmation slip that is sent to Georgetown.
Well, aren't we ignoring the distinction between the corporation and the individual if we accept that argument?
In my opinion, no. O'Hearn didn't take this money. You know where the money ended up? Is in Georgetown's account. Georgetown is just as guilty of the theft as O'Hearn is. It's not like O'Hearn took the check and put it in his personal checking account. The conduct that O'Hearn engaged in, he gave the money to his corporation, and the corporation used that money. How can we now step back and say, well, your employee, James O'Hearn, he was the dirty guy, he did all the theft, but he didn't get the money. The money went to the corporation, and the corporation was responsible for its employees under Respondeat Superior, and in my reply brief addresses all of these topics. The culmination of the theft was the depositing of the money into the Georgetown account. And Georgetown was just as disloyal as O'Hearn. Georgetown had just as much knowledge of O'Hearn's, what he was doing, operating illegally since 1994. They knew that he didn't have a securities license. What happened is, if you look at the, he had a valid securities license, and this is in the state papers, which is appendix page 11, paragraph 2. O'Hearn was licensed as a securities agent from December 6, 91 to August 21st, 92 for Locust Street Securities. Locust Street then terminated his license. He then has to be, in order to sell in this state, a sales agent has to be licensed through what is called a broker-dealer. Georgetown is not a broker-dealer. His broker-dealers are in paragraph 2 on page 11 of the appendix. For a period of time, it was Locust Street. For another period of time, it was Fortis. For another period of time, it was Harbor Investors. But subsequent to July 22, 1994, he never possessed a license. Georgetown knew about that. And they, if you're going to try to distinguish between O'Hearn and Georgetown, the corporation certainly knew that O'Hearn had no license. He's the sole shareholder. How can we step back and say, hey, this corporation of which I'm the sole shareholder of doesn't know of the conduct I'm engaged in? I'm the principal officer. I'm the only contact that the client has in this particular case was that principal officer. So you can't step back and say Georgetown is a separate entity here unknowing as to O'Hearn's conduct. They participated in the conduct. The First Star's argument might carry more weight if O'Hearn took the money and put it in his own pocket. He didn't. He took the money and put it in Georgetown's pocket. Georgetown is just as guilty of the theft. They're just as disloyal. And for those reasons, the limited powers of attorney terminated when that conduct was going. When O'Hearn lost his license in 94, these documents lost any authority. And we can't now 6 years or 7 years later, recreate them and say, hey, we found them. Even though we didn't rely on them, we didn't know about them, it granted the authority. The law says they terminated as a matter of law at that time, in 1994. These transactions didn't happen until 96 through 98. I think I'm going to reserve the yellow light's on unless there's any more questions.
Counsel, you may speak until the red light is on. We'll give you about 4 minutes, 3 or 4 minutes, and then you have 5 minutes in rebuttal.
Counsel, just for clarification purposes, both of these transactions involved Putnam accounts that were liquidated. Is that right?
Yes. There were, actually, the two two at issue here involved Putnam. There were some others that – there was another $120,000 that was stolen by O'Hearn, and we're not – that's not on appeal here.
Okay.
But they were all Putnam accounts.
Well, that's what I thought from the briefing, and I just am having difficulty making out the handwriting on the first of these powers of attorney because it's – kind of chicken scratch. And well, I assume that none of these handwritten line items are the Putnam accounts, and that's conceded.
That's correct. He didn't invest in the Putnam accounts until 1994, 95 area, somewhere in that area, okay. 93 area.
Okay.
I do want to address one last issue, if I lose time here, I'm going to come up on the rebuttal. And that is, I believe my client, we brought a motion for summary judgment, and I believe this court, under its authority, can not only reverse the granting of authority to First Star, but grant summary judgment to my client Schmitz. We had two theories, negligence of First Star in cashing the check and conversion. If there's no authority, as we contend, to cash these checks, if the authority has been terminated, or if the authority didn't allow this conduct, it is a clear case that then First Star cannot cash these checks. And when they did cash the checks, it was a conversion of my client's money. It's not in the brief, but there's a case called Methodist Manor versus Martin, appearing at 202 Wiss Appellate 130, Court of Appeals from 2002. Again, just decided that talks about converting money, and if money can be converted just like any chattel. And I see my red light is on.
Thank you, counsel. You have 5 minutes in rebuttal. Gary P. Lancey, representing First Star Bank.
Good afternoon. As the court indicated, my name is Gary Lancey. I represent First Star Bank. I think the first thing we have to clear up is what was in this power of attorney. What's being argued is that the two examples of the power of attorney that's marked Appendix 6 and 7 was the power of attorney. It's my position that what Appendix 6 and 7 are examples of Georgetown's use of the power of attorney that was given to them. In the cases that are reported, the Alexopoulos case, I think the Prefke case, in those cases, the person that executed the power of attorney is deceased. And so what we have in that case is we have a written document that is the universe, and we have to say, how do we construe that? Contained in the appendix at page 31 and 32 is Mr. Doherty's affidavit regarding the testimony of Mr. Schmitz regarding the execution of the power of attorney. And I'm just going to take a second. Appendix is page 32. And he was asked at line 10, he says, now look, at the very last line of that paragraph, it says, power of attorney also applies to stocks, bonds, and other securities. Do you see that? He answered, yes. Any recollection of discussing with him the authority of Mr. O'Hearn at Georgetown to act on your behalf with respect to stocks, bonds, and other securities? He says, no. Okay. Then he says, And I don't remember ever seeing any of this information ever. I think what I signed was just for the understanding of that life insurance policy only. Question, let me clarify. When you say other stuff, you kind of point it. Do you mean the handwriting or the sentence I just read? I just asked you about all this other information under company name and policy name and number. That's his answer. Oh, okay. You're referring to the handwritten information. It looks like under company name, it looks like American Funds. Is that what you're talking about? Answer, yes. And I think it's liquidate in full. Do not deduct Fed tax. Did I read that correctly? Answer, yes. And that under the policy name and number, it could be AmeriCap. And then there's a number, and it looks like Washington Mutual. And then a number, an investment company of America, a number, and then something cap pension with a question mark. Answer, mm-hmm. And you're saying that handwriting, you do not recall seeing when you sign a document. Is that correct? Answer, correct. So I represent to the court that the power of attorney that was executed by Mr. Schmitz to Georgetown Financial Corporation, a Wisconsin corporation, was the typewritten portion. What he did, he authorized Georgetown Financial to handle his financial affairs. He owned an insurance policy, but he extended the authority to Georgetown Financial to cover stocks, bonds, other securities. Also, Appendix 7, stock, bonds, CDs, annuities, savings accounts, and other securities.
Counsel, what's the point of listing in this handwritten on these handwritten line items these different financial instruments, including an insurance policy and apparently a couple of different mutual funds? What's the point of listing them if this wasn't meant to be limited to them?
Well, I'll give you an example, Judge. When I handle a personal injury case, a client comes into my office, and I have that client sign a medical records release authorization. That medical records release authorization is a printed form authorizing certain people to disclose medical records regarding an accident on a specific date. My client will sign that, but we will not fill in to whom it's going to, because at that point in time, I may not know the scope of all the people where they're going to obtain health care. So as I need to use that medical records release authorization, I fill in the name. So what they do is they go to the financial advisor, give them a power of attorney, and as this relationship evolves and they have to sell different items, they will fill in the name. Now, where we got this, let me take a step back and explain. I think I answered your question. But
no, you didn't. So
okay, what I'm saying, though, is what this is it's an example of Georgetown Financial's use of the power of attorney. Schmitz executed a power of attorney with just a typewriter.
It was just what? I didn't hear that. It was just what?
They had no handwriting on the power of attorney.
I'm having a little difficulty hearing you, counsel.
I'm sorry.
Right. Thank you.
The point of my early exercise with the transcript was to show to the court that at the time that Schmitz executed the power of attorney to Georgetown Financial, there was nothing handwritten on it.
Well, was it that argument makes me concerned whether or not it was a valid power of attorney from the get-go then, a valid and limited power of attorney.
Well, it would be, what he did was he actually executed this document authorizing Georgetown Financial to act on their behalf, to act in my name, place, and stead, to do everything that is required, as if done by me personally, regarding my stocks, bonds, life insurance policies.
Let me ask, why isn't this, and I refer to the second power of attorney, to be interpreted as I, as owner of the insurance policy, or as owner of the security, American Can or whatever it is, or as owner of the whatever, listed below, why isn't it interpreted as a limited power of attorney in that fashion. You're not interpreting this limited power of attorney to read in that fashion. What's wrong? Why am I wrong interpreting it that way?
You're not wrong as far as the items that are listed on that, but it's my position that in the relationship between the financial advisor and the individual, when this relationship is set up, a power of attorney is given. And perhaps I think the trial court, in ruling on the motion for rehearing, said best, if I could take a minute. This appears at appendix page 5. It's Judge Sweetling. He says, well, I think it's clear from considering the entire situation here that Mr. Schmitz retained the services of Georgetown to perform certain acts of financial planning for him, negotiate, purchase and sell stock, negotiate these insurance policies, and so forth. And the reason that the last sentence was added to the powers of attorney was to give Georgetown those broad powers. And certainly, when you go to a financial advisor and you say, all right, here is $100,000, you handle it, that financial advisor is going to want a power of attorney to act on your behalf. They are not going to call you every time a check comes in and have you endorse a check, and that's the situation you have here, that Mr. Schmitz wanted Georgetown to have the ability to act on his behalf, and that's why he executed those two powers of attorney. And that's where the additional language was added to each power of attorney to give Georgetown the broader authority to act on Mr. Schmitz's behalf with respect to transactions involving stocks, bonds, and other securities, including these mutual funds.
If that's true, why are there two that have different line items on them?
Okay, because what happened is...
It seems to me to imply that they knew that each transaction was going to be handled.
And I think on a limited record, I could see where you would, want to go down that road, but let me step back. In July of 96, a check was presented to the bank. First line, it said Eric Schmitz. Second line said care of Georgetown Financial. It had a Georgetown Financial stamp on it, said for deposit only, and was deposited in the account of Georgetown Financial. In March of 98, same thing happened. 3 years, in July of 99, the bank had sued, and the complaint says Georgetown didn't have authority to sell these funds. It didn't have authority to endorse these checks. So now the bank sued 3 years later. Well, we have to find out what authority they have. The records that we've tracked the records to the FBI, because they were prosecuting O'Hearn. The records went from the FBI before we could get them turned over to us. They went from the FBI to Attorney George Kirsten's office, who's handling a class action suit, along with Mr. Doherty. By the time we got to the records, we found these two powers of attorney. The reason they're different is that at two different points of time, Georgetown Financial, on behalf of Mr. Schmitz, was redeeming life insurance policies, redeeming mutual funds, reinvesting it. So at that point in time, we found, wait a minute, this fellow gave these people a power of attorney. They had authority to act. At its deposition, he indicated, when I gave him this power of attorney, this handwriting wasn't on there. This was blank. And so what he gave him was a power of attorney that he could use throughout the relationship at different times.
Well, did he ever testify that that power of attorney was for all purposes, all financial purposes? I thought the evidentiary record in this case supported the construction of the agreements or the powers of attorney that these were limited to what was listed on each power of attorney. Wasn't that the plaintiff's testimony? Not that they were intended to be broad-based powers of attorney to cover all financial transactions by Georgetown on Schmitz's behalf. I thought his testimony was directly contrary to that.
You know, I could tell you how I read this power of attorney.
I'm asking you about his testimony. What did he say?
I'm sorry.
What was his testimony?
His being Schmitz?
Yes.
He testified that he didn't recall the language on there regarding stocks, bonds, but he doesn't recall there being any handwriting on the power of attorney. That's what his testimony in the record that I referenced said.
I heard it. What did he say was going on when he signed these powers of attorney? That the understanding was not that these were to cover all financial transactions that Georgetown and O'Hearn might conceivably conduct on behalf of Schmitz, but only those that were to be listed on the lines.
All I can say is he was asked any recollection of discussing with him, that's George O'Hearn, the authority of Mr. O'Hearn at Georgetown to act on your behalf with respect to stocks, bonds, and other securities. He answered no. He had no recollection of that discussion. But the power of attorney itself, which he signed, authorized Georgetown, to act on his behalf. And so
it authorizes him to act on his behalf with respect to the listed financial transactions.
Yeah,
why would there be line items to list them if this is as broad-based as you're suggesting? That makes no sense to me.
Well, I'm not making myself clear. What I'm saying is, in my example of, the best example I can think of is in a personal injury case when I have a medical records release authorization.
I heard that argument.
Understand.
I'm not buying
it. The reason, if you look through my file, you would see that medical records release authorization. You might see three different examples of it. The printed portion, the typewritten portion would be the same, but there'd be handwritten different names on it because I took that power that my client gave me and I used it in three different occasions with three different medical care providers. What we have here are examples where Georgetown took this power of attorney authorizing them to handle my financial affairs. And we found evidence at one time they used it for American funds, one time they used it for American cap, but that wasn't the only.
Okay, and let's use your medical records example. Let's say you had one of those free-floating medical records release authorizations from your client, except it was signed in blank. Nothing was listed. And let's say your client said, I treated with this doctor, and this doctor, Dr. A, B, and C. And so you subsequently Xeroxed three of these authorizations and filled in Dr. A, Dr. B, Dr. C, and sent them off to those doctors. Then let's say you got separate information that your client treated with Dr. D, and you didn't get permission from your client to get those doctors, and that it would have been a breach of your obligation to your client to get the records from Dr. D because you were not authorized to do so. And you filled in Dr. D and went and got those records anyway.
You're correct. But the general practice, the practice of the industry, is that when that client comes into me and says, I was involved in an accident on July 4th, 2001,
let me rephrase the question. Would you argue that you had the authority to get Dr. D's records even though your client had not given it to you?
Correct. If they're related.
Say no.
If they were related to the accident in which I'm
saying it's unrelated. I'm saying that Dr. D's treatment of your client has nothing to do with what the other doctors did, and that your client would not want you to go and get those records, and you did so anyway. Would you argue that that release form was broad enough to cover it?
No, because that was not within the scope. If I understand your question, I'm representing a client regarding a particular accident. I go to a doctor that did not treat my client for injuries related to that accident. Is that what you're saying? And I use that power of attorney? That would be improper. That would be no different than if they use this power of attorney to try and get Schmitz's medical records. That wasn't the point of this power of attorney.
They're using this power. O'Hearn and Georgetown use this power of attorney, or you're attempting to get us to construe this power of attorney to allow it to be used in a way that was directly in violation of the client's interests.
Well, I don't think it was in violation of the client's interest, but I'd like to point out.
How can it not have been?
Well, let me point out one other thing in the record. Okay.
In a way that was not authorized, because it certainly wasn't.
We don't have a copy of the power of attorney that may have been used for putting up funds.
But so we have to assume it does not exist.
Well,
there is nothing in the record to support the supposition or speculation or guesswork that one existed. So don't even go there.
I'd refer the Court to Appendix page 17. Mr. Doherty is claiming that as a result of O'Hearn's loss of a securities license in 94, this power of attorney evaporated. It's our position that the power of attorney was given to Georgetown Financial Corporation, a Wisconsin corporation. At Appendix page 17 is the affidavit of Eric Schmitz. Attached to that, at Appendix 22, is the account application signed by Mr. Schmitz. He indicated that this was the account application given to purchase these funds, and they were purchased through Georgetown Financial Corporation. The account registration on page 22, Schmitz gives up his name, his Social Security number, and his date of birth. His address he gives as Georgetown Financial Corporation. That's in Appendix 23. His investment advisor at Appendix 24 isn't listed George O'Hearn. It's listed as C. Little Hearn at a brokerage of Ogilvie and Taylor. So there are other brokers at Georgetown Financial to whom this power of attorney was given. On the same page, Appendix 24, there's a telephone redemption privilege. He authorizes as follows: unless I have checked the box to the right, Putnam Investor Services is authorized to act upon instructions received by telephone from me or any person claiming to act as my representative who can provide Putnam with my account registration and address as it appears on Putnam's records. So what he does is he gives this information to Georgetown Financial, which Georgetown Financial can use as authority to redeem the Putnam funds. This is not only another authorization for Georgetown Financial to act on behalf of Schmitz, but it's also indicative. This was signed by Schmitz in 1995. O'Hearn lost his license in 94. So it goes to show that despite this claim that O'Hearn lost his license and it terminated, it indicates that as far as Schmitz is concerned, the relationship is continuing and he's giving Georgetown Financial authority to act on his behalf, not only through the power of attorney, but through this account application and the telephone redemption privileges.
Did Schmitz know that O'Hearn had lost his license when he signed this document?
I don't think Schmitz knew. I don't think the bank knew. Nobody knew.
And this is a fraudulently obtained document.
Right. And I think he has a cause of action. I think Mr. Schmitz has a cause of action against Mr. O'Hearn.
But you can hardly build your case, your defense, I should say, on a fraudulently obtained document.
I don't know why it's fraudulently obtained.
Because he had lost his license and he's still.
I know, but.
Representing
the
client and getting him to enter into agreements to negotiate securities.
Appendix 24 doesn't list James O'Hearn as the broker, the investment advisor. It lists C. Little Hearn as the investment advisor. Now, what I'm saying is the bank's position was we get a check. On the first line, it says Eric Schmitz. On the second line, it says care of Georgetown Financial. We have a stamp on the bank, an endorsement and stamp. It says Georgetown Financial for deposit only, and it's deposited into the account of Georgetown Financial. Now, what did the bank do wrong? Now, if
isn't it significant that it didn't say O'Hearn or Schmitz, I mean, and Georgetown Financial, but rather it said care of Georgetown Financial? Isn't that a difference that's significant?
I think it's significant if this thing has, if this case has to go back, if the court doesn't agree that Georgetown Financial had authority, because I think the court was referred to a change in the law in 96.
Mm-hmm.
Under Article 3 of the Uniform Commercial Code, there's a section regarding joint payees. This one check was in 96, the other was in 98. I think in July 1st, 96, there was a change in law. And I think there's a question of fact as to whether when a check is made out, Eric Schmidt's care of Georgetown Financial, is that ambiguous? If it's ambiguous, after July 1st, 96, you only need one signature to endorse it.
That sounds like a question of law to me. I mean, what did the law require in 96 and what did it require in 98?
Right, but I think...
If it's made out to Schmidt and care of.
Now, on the earlier, we had four checks. Two of the later checks were made out Eric Schmidt's Georgetown Financial, no care of. We brought a motion for summary judgment on that saying, listen, that's ambiguous. And under the change after July 1st, 96, if it's ambiguous, you don't need both signatures. You only need one signature. And that's what the law was. So I think you're right. I think you could rule as a matter of law whether or not that's ambiguous and what law would apply. But we didn't move for a motion for summary judgment on that basis. We moved for a motion for summary judgment on the basis that Georgetown Financial was authorized to act on behalf of Schmidt's in negotiating these checks pursuant to these powers of attorney.
Would it be your position then that where it's Schmidt's care of, that that's ambiguous and therefore that it was sufficient to merely stamp it with Georgetown for deposit only?
That would have to be my position, advocating the bank's position.
And that would be both checks. You're talking about both the $58,000 check and the $6,000 check.
Well, to be consistent, I would have to take that. I would say as to both checks.
And is the law with you or against you?
I know that it was for me on one, against me on the other.
And which is which? The really big check. Is the law against you?
The small one.
I'm sorry.
The law is for me on the small one, against me on the big one.
Okay.
And why is that? Why don't you spell that out for us?
The only reason is there was a change in the law in July of 96. If the payees on a check were ambiguous before that date, you needed two signatures. After that date, if it was ambiguous, you only need one signature. They were alternative.
Assuming, for the sake of argument, that the two 1992 powers of attorney granted actual authority, when was that, when, if ever, was that authority terminated?
The powers of attorney do not have a revocation date on them. I would say that... imagine when that relationship would come to an end.
I didn't
know. When Schmidt's would say, I no longer want Robert W. Baird to be my broker, I'm going to go with Morgan Stanley. I've never researched it. I've researched the idea of personal guarantees, and I know an attorney, if a client comes in and he's going to leave someone, you better revoke a personal guarantee. I haven't researched whether or not it's necessary to revoke a power of attorney, like you would a personal guarantee.
There are no circumstances under which it would be considered revoked as a matter of law or by operation of law? Such as under the circumstances of this case?
Yeah, not off the top of my head. With the research I've done, I didn't say anything. Listen, this would revoke.
Well, what about the restatement of agency provisions that are cited by the plaintiff here that provide for?
Using that, the medical records release authorization, if I were to lose my license, okay, that would maybe revoke, but the position that the Court of Appeals took, if you deal with a third party and the third party has no knowledge of that and relies on that power of attorney, then...
But those principles only come into play in the case of a disclosed or partially disclosed principle, in other words, apparent authority, which you concede is not at issue here.
That's right.
So that part the Court of Appeals definitely got wrong, right?
Right. We can't rely on apparent authority because...
Okay. So you're conceding that that's wrong. And so by operation of the other principles of the restatement, 108, 111, and 112, the circumstances here amount to a termination of the powers of attorney, assuming that they can be construed broadly enough to encompass the transactions at issue here, that those powers of attorney terminated by operation of law.
I could see why the Court would argue that, but I think it flies in the face of the Putnam transaction in 1995, where on one hand he's saying, listen, the power of attorney, everything's done in 1994, yet he continues the relationship in 1995, authorizing Georgetown Financial to deal with Putnam. So my answer to that is it's sort of a red herring because you've got this subsequent authority. But I see my light's on. I guess I'd like to summarize real quick.
Can I just ask you one question? I'm sorry. Namely, were all these limited powers of attorney on file with First Star?
None. All we knew was we received a check.
Okay.
Eric Schmitz. All we did was it's my position that if Schmitz had dealt with Morgan Stanley or Robert W. Baird and Company and executed a similar power of attorney, Morgan Stanley or Robert W. Baird would have authority to act on behalf of Schmitz, selling mutual funds, negotiating the proceeds checks. If a rogue broker at Morgan Stanley or Robert W. Baird took the proceeds of Schmitz investments out of the account of Morgan Stanley or Robert W. Baird, Schmitz would have an action against both the broker and the brokerage. In this case, Schmitz has a similar claim against O'Hearn at Georgetown Financial. If the brokerages were Morgan Stanley or Robert W. Baird, the brokerages or their insurance companies would make good the loss to Schmitz. In our fact situation, O'Hearn, the rogue brokers in jail, and Georgetown Financial is out of business. But there are no policy reasons to shift the loss to First Star, who properly negotiated the Putnam checks based upon the authority given by Schmitz to Georgetown. And I think that's what this case comes down to. If you have any further questions, I'd be happy to answer them. Other than that,
Thank you, Mr. Lansky. Mr. Doherty?
Thank you. I want to reemphasize a couple of things. It appears the Court here today has focused on what authority was contained in these limited powers of attorney. I don't want to lose the perspective, even if the Court concludes that there was the power, to the actual authority to deal with the theft of my client's money, these powers of attorney terminated as a matter of law. Justice Crooks raised the point of this corporation. I don't want to lose perspective here. A corporation operates through human beings. It can only conduct business through human beings. Georgetown did not have a license to buy and sell securities. Only their agents did, their employee. And the only employee in this record that had any contact with my client was James O'Hearn. And his license was terminated in 94. His ability to deal in securities terminated. And it was illegal for him to do so from that date forward. The point counsel made about these medical authorizations begs the question. In his blank authorizations, you have to insert a name, exactly what is here. And he conceded that if he didn't have the authority as the agent, he couldn't go out and put in a blank name. And it's a similar situation as here. These limited powers of attorney, we have never found one that says he could deal with Putnam and cash the Putnam check.
Counsel, let me use this as the hypothetical posed by your opposing counsel. Let's say this is a Robert Baird account, and I sign, and I have a broker or a financial advisor that I trust, and I just sign a power of attorney for them to handle all that stuff. I mean, I don't anticipate that when they sell one stock and buy the other that I'm going to be contacted to, again, to relist the new acquisition. I mean, every time they buy and sell something.
But that's not a proper analogy. He'd have an action against the brokerage and its employee, yes. But we haven't got a situation. Are you dealing with a parent authority? Because under his situation, there's a parent authority is there. And yes, then I agree with you that if the bank takes it under apparent authority principles, it's a proper handling of the check. We still haven't addressed the negotiation about, you know, was there a valid negotiation, which I contend there is not. But the fact of the matter is, if it's under actual authority, and the employer, Morgan Stanley, Baird, whoever, is aware that their agent, in this case O'Hearn, lost his license, and they're clearly aware of it, and they can allow him to continue to operate, that authority, under actual authority principles, has terminated. And the bank has no right to rely on the conduct of Morgan Stanley under actual authority any more than it had the right to rely on Georgetown. Georgetown can't do anything buying and selling securities. It doesn't have a license. Only its agent does, O'Hearn. It was lost. And if it's Morgan Stanley, the same principles of law would apply. And if the bank, taking that, and again, get apparent authority out of this case, which would be hard to do in a major brokerage firm. But if dealing on actual authority principles, a bank did the same thing with Morgan Stanley, and Morgan Stanley possessed the knowledge that its agent was acting disloyally, and that they, once they got the money, the Morgan Stanley was intending to steal it, like Georgetown did here, that authority terminated. And if the bank doesn't have apparent authority to rely on, if they're relying on actual authority, which they'd have no knowledge that Morgan Stanley has that authority, it's the same exact situation. I don't care how big the corporation is. It's what knowledge does the corporation have as to its conduct of itself and its employees? And the Steinberg Holmes case I cited in my case, that case there was an employee who didn't hook up the trailer correctly. The corporation, even though the corporation's back home, the guy's out on the road, the corporation was found criminally liable because under the principles of actual authority, that's the way the law works.
Well, but then this case turns on the unique situation that Georgetown isn't itself a licensed brokerage firm. And indeed, O'Hearn is the principal of Georgetown, and that Georgetown really knew everything that O'Hearn was doing. I mean,
no, it does not. What it turns on is in order for O'Hearn to conduct the buying and selling of securities legally, he has to possess a license. And that license, once he was terminated by his license by the last one in July of 1994, notice is sent to the brokerage. Your employee has lost his license. He can't operate legally. How can we say that Georgetown, which Georgetown really is O'Hearn, he's the 100% shareholder, how can we say he doesn't have notice of not having a license? It begs the question. And my time is up unless there's any more questions. I thank the court for attention and patience.
Thank you, Mr. Doherty. I'm sorry, I'm going to just ask you one question. Your brief ends with the conclusion that you want us to take the petition for review. What relief do you want? You want summary judgment in your favor?
I want the court to reverse the granting of summary judgment to the defendant First Star and to take the power that it has and grant the plaintiff summary judgment.
And if not, remand it to the circuit court.
Correct.
Okay, thank you. Thank you, Mr. Doherty, and thank you, Mr. Lance Nancy, for your arguments this afternoon. That ends the hearing on 01-2139, Eric M. Schmitz versus First Star Bank of Milwaukee. The court's in recess until its next oral argument next week.
Thank you.